I was examining the chitin shells of insects under my microscope in the summer of 1988, along with their pinnate antennae, the fish scale microstructure of butterfly wings, iridescent colors, and other inventions of nature. I became interested in an amazingly rhythmical microstructure of one large insect wing casing. It was an extremely well-ordered composition, as though stamped out by factory equipment according to special blueprints and calculations. As I saw it, the intricate sponginess was clearly unnecessary, either for the strength of the part or for its decoration. I have never observed anything like this unusual micro-ornament, either in nature, in technology, or in art. Because its structure is three-dimensional, I have been unable to capture it in a drawing so far, or a photograph. Was it perhaps a wave emitter using my multiple cavity structures effect? That truly lucky summer, there were very many insects of this species, and I would capture them at night. I placed the small concave chitin plate on the microscope stage in order to again examine its strangely star-shaped cells under strong magnification. I again admired this masterpiece jewel work of nature. I was about to place a second identical plate with the same unusual cell structure on its underside, almost purposelessly on top of the first one. But then, the little plate came loose from my tweezers, hung suspended above the other plate on the microscope stage for a few seconds, then turned a few degrees clockwise and slid to the right, then turned counterclockwise and swung, and only then it abruptly fell on the desk. You can imagine what I felt at that moment. When I came to my senses, I tied a few panels together with a wire, and it wasn't an easy thing to do. I succeeded only when I positioned them vertically. What I got was a multi-layered chitin block, and I placed it on the desk. Even a relatively large object, such as a thumbtack, would not fall on it. Something pushed it up and aside. When I attached the tack on top of the block, I witnessed incredible, impossible things. The tack would disappear from sight for a few moments. That was when I realized that this was no beacon, but something entirely different. And I became again so excited that all the objects around me became foggy and shaky. I managed to pull myself together with huge effort in a couple of hours, and I continued working. This is how it all started. Of course, much still remains to be understood, verified, and tested. These results are spectacular to a conventional mindset, leading most to conclude Dr. Grebennikov must be lying. But already we are seeing an effect consistent with our model. When he put the tack in the direct center of the vortex current created by the insect's wing casing, the tack's atoms all popped over into time-space, and it seemingly disappeared. In a 2005 issue of New Energy Technologies, we find out that although Grebennikov never disclosed the exact genus and species of the insect he discovered this effect with, he does make multiple mentions in his book about the remarkable properties of the wing cases for scarabaeus, bronze poplar borer, and particularly Cetonia. There are five species of bronze poplar borer that have an unusual honeycomb pattern on the inside of their wing cases, similar to his description. So if you really love Mother Nature, you just might learn something. Some folks here on Earth have apparently been aware of these dueling gravitational forces for thousands and thousands of years, and the techniques to overcome normal downward gravitational flow by understanding how to speed up the spiraling motion within the source field to create currents that push in a different direction. This appears to be the great secret of how the pyramids were built. However, we still haven't really answered our deeper question. How do we pop enough atoms over into time-space to actually make an object levitate? Once again, an old friend comes to the rescue: coherence. We need to bring the frequency inside the atom to a point that is faster than light speed, so it then pops over into time-space. This can be done by creating a harmonic pulsation in the source field, in gravity. So, if we want the magic to happen, all we have to do is start vibrating an object or a given area with the right frequencies. Then, by creating coherence in that area, some of the atoms will start popping over the light speed boundary, where they then get pushed on by what we call levity. Tibetan acoustic levitation. This might sound complicated, but the actual techniques are easy once you know what you're doing, and hardly any technology is required to create the coherence. The most intriguing example I've ever discovered is called Tibetan acoustic levitation, and this is another piece of weird science that I struggled for years to understand. This comes to us from Henry Kjellson, a Swedish aircraft designer who described the whole story to a journalist who then published it in a German magazine. A truly groundbreaking New Zealand researcher named Bruce Cathy then wrote a detailed analysis of it in David Hatcher Chodras's Anti-Gravity and the World Grid. Henry Kjellson was a close friend and colleague of a medical doctor also from Sweden who chose to be identified only as Dr. Jarl. According to Kjellson, Dr. Jarl befriended a young Tibetan student while he studied at Oxford. When Dr. Jarl was later paid to visit Egypt by a scientific society in England, his Tibetan friend found out and sent a messenger to find him. The message was very good. Dr. Jarl's friend had become a trusted member of the monastery, and now a high Tibetan Lama said he wanted to meet Dr. Jarl urgently. Apparently, Dr. Jarl then got permission to stay in Tibet for a fairly long time, take notes, and report back on what he found. While he was there, Dr. Jarl got to see a variety of things that few Westerners had ever been allowed to witness before. The greatest secret of all, according to Swedish engineer Olaf Alexanderson, was that a vibrating and condensed sound field can nullify the power of gravitation. Other experts on Tibet, including Linaver, Spalding, and Hui, had heard about the Tibetans using sound to levitate gigantic stones, and Dr. Jarl had also heard about these legends, but he was the first Westerner to witness it. Dr. Jarl was led into a sloping meadow that was surrounded by high cliffs to the northwest. One of the cliffs had a ledge that led into a cave, some 250 meters above the ground. The Tibetans were in the process of building a wall out of huge stone blocks up on this ledge, but there was no way to get there except by climbing straight up on a rope. About 250 meters away from the cliff, there was a polished rock slab that had a bowl-shaped area carved out of the middle of it. The slab was a meter wide, and the bowl area was 15 centimeters deep. Then, a team of yak oxen hauled a giant stone block into the bowl. The stone was incredibly huge. It was a full meter high and a meter and a half long. Here's the weird part. A perfect quarter circle arc, 90 degrees, was set up with 13 drums and 6 trumpets, all aiming at the stone. All the drums were made of 3 millimeter thick sheet iron. And instead of any type of animal skin for a head, there was metal on the end that the monks beat with leather clubs. The other end was left open. The 6 trumpets were all quite long, 3.12 meters to be exact, with 0.3 meter openings. The monks carefully measured the distance from the stone to this quarter circle of instruments, and it came out to 63 meters. 8 of the 13 drums were exactly the same size as the stone, a meter wide and a meter and a half long. 4 of the drums were smaller in size, but were exactly one-third the volume of the larger drum, at 0.7 meters wide and 1 meter long. One additional drum was the smallest, at 0.2 meters wide and 0.3 meters long, again, in perfect harmonic proportion. You could fit 41 of the small drums into the medium drum in volume and 125 into the larger drum. All the instruments were fixed on mounts, that allowed you to precisely aim them. And finally, you needed another key ingredient to make it work. A total of nearly 200 monks who lined up in rows about 8 or 10 deep behind each of the 19 instruments. Most people wouldn't think the monks could add any measurable energy to the mix. But with what we now know about the source field, all that has changed. It seemed that the instruments were tools that helped focus and concentrate the energy that was being consciously generated by the monks. This is also why the experiment might not work if the people lining up behind each instrument were not properly trained in generating coherence within themselves through meditation. Now, let's hear directly from Bruce Cathy about what happened next. When the stone was in position, the monk behind the small drum gave a signal to start the concert. The small drum had a very sharp sound and could be heard even with the other instruments making a terrible din. All the monks were singing and chanting a prayer, slowly increasing the tempo of this unbelievable noise. During the first 4 minutes, nothing happened. Then, as the speed of the drumming and the noise increased, the big stone block started to rock and sway, and suddenly it took off into the air with an increasing speed in the direction of the platform in front of the cave hole 250 meters high. After 3 minutes of ascent, it landed on the platform. Incredible! We're watching a gigantic stone as big as some of the ones used to build the Great Pyramid, making a long, slow, lumbering 3-minute trip up through the air in a 500-meter arc. Obviously, the power of the drums, trumpets, and chanting is nowhere near enough to cause an object to levitate by any conventional means. But if they were creating the right coherence in the block, they could resonate atoms inside the rock over the light speed boundary. They then enter into time space and provide thrust as they get pushed on by the levity force. If you touched the rock during this time, it would have almost certainly become spongy, since as many as half of the molecules are no longer in our reality. This appears to be how the gigantic stone blocks in Peru at Sacsayhuaman were able to be fitted together with cracks so tight you can't even fit a razor blade between them. The rocks become soft and malleable like clay as their builders popped more and more of the atoms into time-space. As we already saw in the tornado anomalies, there are many examples of solid materials becoming soft and spongy when they become coherent. Some of the stones split from the intensity, and the monks moved them away. Nonetheless, they were able to keep the production line going and transport a total of 5 or 6 blocks an hour with this method. Now here's the incredible part. Dr. Jarl thought he was either being hypnotized or going through some sort of mass psychosis. So he actually set up a movie camera and filmed the whole process 2 different times. When he played the films back later on, they showed exactly the same thing he had witnessed. Dr. Jarl was astonished and obviously felt this discovery would shake the very foundations of the world as we know it, maybe even literally. When the scientific society that had been sponsoring Dr. Jarl heard about these films, disaster struck. They swooped in and confiscated the originals, declaring them classified, which Dr. Jarl felt was hard to explain or understand. They tried to appease him by saying the films would be released in the year 1990, but this obviously never happened. Building a craft you can fly in. This form of levitation still seems to be a cumbersome process and may require a level of consciousness that most of us do not now possess. What if we build something where the propulsion system is inside a craft we can actually fly in? Let's go back to Dr. Victor Schauberger, who found levitation effects occurring with trout and rocks in water. He built structures with the same egg shape he saw in the rocks and built special turbines that rotated water at a high speed inside them, creating the same vortex shapes he had carefully observed in nature. There is a great wealth of reading material on how he succeeded in building a working gravity-shielding craft by using this process. Researchers such as Nick Cook and Joseph Farrell have written about how this and other technologies came into the hands of Nazi Germany, though there is clear evidence that Schauberger resisted cooperating with them and only ended up participating because of dire threats to him and his family. In Nick Cook's The Hunt for Zero Point, he explains that the Nazi code word for this gravity shielding project was Kronos, which means time. As our model predicts, the Nazis apparently found that a movement through space creates a movement through time. If you generate a torsion field of sufficient magnitude, the theory says you can bend the four dimensions of space around Schauberger's generator. The more torsion you generate, the more space you perturb. When you bend space, you also bend time. Later, Cook goes into more detail. If a whirling torsion field, with or without an electromagnetic component, was binding with gravity to produce a levitational effect, an anti-gravity effect, it wasn't doing so in the four dimensions of this world, but somewhere else. It explained why the Germans had attempted to use a torsion field to act upon the fourth dimension of time. Time, like gravity, the theorists said, was simply another variable stemming from the hyperspace. Dr. Viktor Grebennikov, who discovered a gravity-shielding effect in insect wings, was also able to use this discovery to build a working craft that was big enough for him to fly in. He organized multiple wing cases together on layers that could open and close like Venetian blinds, designed to spread open like an oriental fan. The lifting power of the wings would dramatically increase when you cross them over the tops of each other. And this mechanical system allowed him to control that process. When they were all stacked on top of each other, he achieved plenty of vertical lift. He then built this mechanism into a small, rectangular wooden box. I chose a rectangular design because it is easier to fold, and once folded, it may resemble a suitcase or a painter's case, and it can be therefore disguised and not arouse any suspicions. I have naturally chosen a painter's case. He would ride it standing up like a scooter. The vertical thrust was controlled by a bicycle brake caliper that could open and close the fan-like layers of wing cases. His forward speed was controlled by a second brake caliper that determined the tilt angle of the wings. He steered by leaning his body and belted himself to the metal pole that held the handlebars for the bicycle calipers. Grebennikov's account of what actually happened when he used this device fits with our model so perfectly well that this seems very unlikely to be a hoax. First of all, since he popped over into time-space, once he reached a certain height, he looked more like a wave to viewers on the ground. When in flight, I can't be seen from the ground, and not just because of the distance. I cast almost no shadow, even in a very low flight. Yet, as I found out later, people sometimes see something where I am in the sky. I appear to them either as a light sphere, a disc, or something like a slanted cloud with sharp edges, which moves strangely according to them, not exactly the way a real cloud would. He also experienced time distortions, such as the inability to close his camera shutter. I could see, but couldn't take photographs. My camera shutter wouldn't close, and both rolls of film I had with me, one in the camera and the other in my pocket, got light struck. This reminds me of Sid Hurwicz's device, where Grebennikov's experience of time became so much faster than the time flow in his camera that his pressure on the button did not last long enough to actually open the shutter. If he were patient enough, it might work, but he'd probably have to wait a while. Best of all, he found out that by simply traveling through space using gravity shielding, he also automatically traveled through time. By the way, besides the camera, I have experienced sometimes trouble with my watch, and possibly also with the calendar. While descending onto a familiar glade, I would occasionally find it slightly out of season, with about a 2-week deviation. Thus, it may be possible to fly not just in space, but also, or so it seems, in time. I cannot make the latter claim with a 100% guarantee, except perhaps that in flight, particularly at its beginning, a watch runs erratically, now too slow and then too fast. But the watch is at its accurate time and speed at the end of the excursions. Nevertheless, this is one of the reasons why I stay away from people during my journeys. If time manipulation is involved alongside the manipulation of gravitation, I might perhaps accidentally disrupt cause and effect of relations, and someone might get hurt. This is where my fears were coming from. Grebennikov also tried to bring insects back, only to have them disappear from the tube. However, in one case, a captured adult insect reverted back to a living chrysalis stage when he brought it back, showing an undeniable time travel effect. Insects captured there disappear from my test tubes, boxes, and other receptacles. They disappear mostly without a trace. Once I had a test tube crushed to tiny bits in my pocket. Another time, there was an oval hole in the tube glass with brown edges, as though it was chitin-colored. I did feel a kind of burning or an electric shock inside my pocket on many occasions, perhaps at the moment of my prisoner's disappearance.